Welcome to Access Advocacy on thepowerofvoices.com. I'm Adrienne Shapiro. The goals of Access Advocacy are to improve the lives of patients and caregivers who are dealing with the chronic illness of sickle cell disease. We've been speaking a lot about healthcare and science in the state of California and our need for our elected officials to have those issues be top priority. So today we're speaking with Andy Thorburn, who is running for Congressional District 39. And I had the pleasure of meeting him at a Huntington's gala. And we started talking, and I thought, God, he would be a perfect person to have this discussion with about, or continue our discussion on healthcare, what elected officials can do, how it is we can work with them, and really how the whole picture of healthcare in terms of insurance companies and our big business, and how it is that all of this ties together with what really affects our pocketbook. So I want to say, first of all, welcome, Andy.
Thank you. Thank you. My pleasure.
Great. Will you tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
I'd be happy to. I think most relevant to this conversation would be the fact that since 1999, I have actually been an officer of an international insurance company that sells medical insurance pretty much all over the world. And we don't sell a lot of insurance in the United States. Our exposure, so to speak, to the United States, our knowledge of the United States market comes from the fact that many of our clients who are overseas come to the U.S. for treatment. So we've had to become very familiar as an insurance company with reimbursement methods in the United States. But since 1999, I think most relevant to your listeners would be the fact that we've run this company. We now have clients in probably 150 or 160 different countries who buy medical insurance for us, and generally gives them the right to have treatment in their home country. But if their home country is a place like Venezuela, where there's quite a lot of chaos right now, and if they can afford it, they're obviously going to prefer to go to some place like Florida to have their treatment. So that's kind of my background for since 1999 that I think is relevant to this conversation.
Wow, I'm learning so much. I mean, I had no idea that there were companies that actually handle those kind of situations. Our experience, of course, here mostly with insurance is a California car insurance, home insurance, really earthquake insurance, and then the nightmare of healthcare insurance.
Right, correct. Well, you know, the United States is very unusual amongst the wealthy nations particularly. You know, there's these 30 or 35 countries that are considered the most developed countries in the world, and in that club, we're probably unique in the sense that our insurance, our medical plans, other than people who are over 65 and have Medicare, but for the working population, we're unique in that medical care is often tied to the employer buying a plan. That's not very common in the world. And second of all, we are totally unique, as far as I know, within the rich countries club, that it's totally privatized without a mandate to buy insurance. So when you go through the developed world, they all have some form of universal care. Now, the universal care in some countries like Switzerland is provided by private insurance companies, but every single person must participate in the insurance pool. Other countries, as I'm sure everybody knows, like Canada, everybody gets insurance through taxpayer-supported single-payer plans. And then you have the situation in the United Kingdom, in England, where it's not only paid by taxpayers, but the doctors and hospitals actually work for the government directly. So there's a couple of different models out there, but the United States is the only country that doesn't have a total mandate and also provides it through private health insurance. And that has turned out to be a very bad combination.
Well, it becomes, my understanding is, the reason it's so bad for us is A, that our insurance companies are corporations and their goal is to earn money.
Right.
And
well, that's certainly true.
And money for their their investors, money for, you know, basically for those people who have invested in their companies, the goal is not to help people get the best health care available, or even to some extent the proper health care that's, you know, the mandated treatments.
Well, I think there's no doubt that the United States does have a profit margin, a profit motive built into the delivery of health care because it's private insurance that pays most of the bills. But I don't think that's necessarily the only problem and may not even be the fundamental problem, because both both Holland, you know, the Netherlands and Switzerland and some other countries, they actually do provide that medical care is paid for by private insurance companies, and they do make a profit. But, and it's a very big difference, the prices are much lower than the United States because every single citizen has to buy insurance. So the biggest flaw in the United States system is that many healthy people, tens of millions of healthy people that are young, not making a lot of money, or sometimes they're making money, but they feel invulnerable because they're very young, and they don't feel the need to buy health insurance, and we don't force them to buy health insurance. The Obamacare obviously did institute a mandate for the first time, and during the mandate period until the new administration came in, medical costs in this country did begin to rise at a much lower rate than they were rising before the mandate came in. And so there's a critical point here. In addition to the fact that there's a profit motive, the way insurance works the best, particularly on the medical side, is when the pool of insured people is totally inclusive. So now you have some healthy people paying their premiums in case they have a catastrophe, an automobile accident or something like that, but they won't have a lot of claims, and that pulls the price down for everybody. So the problem in the United States has been we didn't have a universal pool. That forces the insurance companies to do a lot of underwriting where they can turn people down who had pre-existing conditions because they're not forced to accept everybody who applies. And this plays into my previous point. Hopefully this will be clear to people listening on the phone, on the radio. When you say to an insurance company, everybody is not going to buy the policy, the company then only can protect itself by saying, if everybody isn't going to buy it, I have to be able to choose who I'm going to sell it to. And that's created most of the problems in the U.S. system. They will turn you down if you're sick because they're not getting the person who's healthy. If you turn it around and say, look, everybody's going to buy the product, the price comes way down because of the scale involved. So in the United States, we have several problems. One is the lack of a genuine enforceable mandate that puts everybody into a plan. And the second one is, because of that lack of a mandate, the insurance companies have to protect their profit margins by strict underwriting, by turning down claims, by being very difficult to deal with. Otherwise, they would never make money.
Thank you. That's a very good explanation of that. I think everyone would find that helpful. I certainly did. The other issue that we face is, for us, our chronically ill community, really is the complications involved in the insurance company and the hospital and how all that works out financially for us. We go to the hospital and we depend on the hospital to keep us alive. But it's so confusing when you go and you give them your insurance card and you think everything is covered and you know you are insured and you get treatment, and then all of a sudden you are hit with all of these bills for services given to you while you were in the hospital, and it just seems to come out of nowhere.
Well, that's exactly right. That's one of the really terrible features of the complexity of the U.S. system. And it's actually, I could tell you, it's much worse than people think. If you could look under the cover and see how it really operates and how those bills and how those charges are calculated and how they're reimbursed by various entities, it's actually much worse, much less equitable, and much less efficient than it even sounds on the surface. It is a feature of the points we talked about before. It's a very Byzantine, complex system that we developed in the United States. And so the insurance companies and all the other providers in this entire ecosystem have developed very complex methods for the purpose of trying to protect their profit margins partly because they don't have a big enough scale to be sure to make money, and partly because it's not paid by the taxpayers. So you have to go in one direction or the other. You either have to have, which we favor, a single-payer system supported by taxpayer dollars. Everybody's covered. Benefits are described by the government, proscribed by the government, and it's paid directly by the government, and you do away with all that administrative cost. Nobody knows the actual number, but the estimates are that in the United States, maybe as much as 15 or 20 cents of every dollar that we do actually spend on medical care actually goes to these administrative arguments that you referred to, where a company says, we're not going to pay that, that comes out of pocket, or they might argue with another insurance company. Think about a situation where you're in an automobile accident and you go to the hospital. There's going to be an argument behind the scenes between your automobile insurance company and your medical company over who pays that bill. And so they might end up deciding, and there's all kinds of rules. There's pages and pages of rules over who pays the bill. So it's a very complicated, overly complex system, which leads to enormous inefficiency, which leads to very, very high expenses for outcomes that are much less than what you get in the rest of the world.
Well, that explains why my doctor's office has so many people who are not nurses. And even my daughter's infusion clinic, I mean, it's very interesting. They have one person that intakes you, right? And then they have another person that does kind of over the billing and the coding of those bills.
Right.
And so I think there are like three people that are doing that work. And I mean, that's a lot of people when you think about it. Full-time employees.
And there's entire industries built around this. There are companies that do nothing but medical bill. A lot of small, medium-sized doctor medical practices, you know, these group practices that most of us go to, they very often outsource billing to an independent firm that has nothing to do with medical at all. They just do the billing. And they get a fee for doing that, so that's another layer of complexity added in. And almost everything is actually firms that do nothing but verify the address of hospitals for 5 cents a claim. Because we have so many different ways that these hospitals are reimbursed. It goes on and on. There's just many, many levels of administrative complexity. You identified a couple of them. Let me take a few minutes and give you another idea of how inequitable the system is. Let's take a look at three different scenarios, and I think you'll see how completely nuts the system really is, Adrian. Let's say that there's three different people. One person is totally uninsured. Is in an automobile accident, goes to the hospital and is treated. That person, let's say it's a $100,000 bill. That $100,000, first, they will try to get as much as they can from the patient. So when the patient is bankrupt, the government, the state government, will pay the rest. And so that person is normally the medical bills. In order to make sure the hospitals don't go bankrupt, the state usually pays it. They have an uninsured fund and they pay it. It's $100,000. Now let's take the second person, same exact accident, goes to the same hospital, has exactly the same treatment, and is billed $100,000, but the person is insured by, let's say, a Cigna or a pretty big insurance company. That $100,000 bill now goes to the patient, it's repriced to $60,000, and the insured person, for that insured person, the medical provider will only get $60,000 of the $100,000, and the other $40,000 will be forgiven. It gets wiped away. It's wiped away. So it's bizarre that the person who's uninsured will cost himself and the government $100,000. The Aetna companies and the big insurance companies will only pay $60,000. They get a discount, just like you would get a discount for buying a car. Let's take a third person. The third person is over 65 and is on Medicare. That person has the same accident, goes to the same hospital, gets the same $100,000 bill. Medicare will only pay $40,000, and the other $60,000 will be forgiven by the hospital. So it's a completely nutty system. So the same exact treatment in the same hospital, they'll get more money from the person who has less money, and they'll get the least amount of money when you're totally insured by Medicare. And that's how complex the system is. That is all these different layers of payments built into it.
Wow. When I look at that, I'm thinking a little bit how now I'm understanding what happens when, for example, I'm being told all the time that the hematologists who treat people living with sickle cell get paid less when they're working or treating someone with sickle cell than they do if it's a person with cancer. And it's always confused me because both require specialized care, right, in the same settings. And sometimes the sickle cell patients are even on, they're on hydroxyurea, which is a cancer-like treatment. And they require infusions, they require blood transfusions, pain meds, all in many ways, a lot of the things that cancer patients are need in their treatment. Yet, when it comes to being reimbursed, the billing codes are different, and therefore the docs receive less money, and it makes it harder for us to find care.
Exactly, and it's probably most likely the plan is also the money's being reimbursed on sickle cell, being reimbursed by a government program, which is going to pay a smaller percentage of the reimbursement than a private insurance company would.
Absolutely.
So that's all part of the craziness of our system. But there's another implication to it that shows why we pay so much money, and I think you know the numbers, but let's just make sure everybody knows. In the United States, in the aggregate, the United States as a country spends about 17 or 18% of our gross domestic product on paying for medical care. So almost 20 cents, not quite 20 cents, of every dollar produced in this country for all the goods and services, we pay about 18 cents of that dollar for medical care. Well, the rest of the world, and again, I'm only talking about the world with has great medical care, you know, the Western world, the advanced economies, Western Europe, Japan, Australia, they pay anywhere from 8 to 12 cents on the dollar. 8%, 10%, 12% of their GDP. So you can go, if you lived in France or Italy, you would have better care in the sense of usually better outcomes, you know, higher, longer life expectancy, lower infant mortality, cancer rates are about the same, certain treatments might be better, certain might not be as well, but overall, for better outcomes, these countries are spending 50% less than we are, and the reason relates to these things that you and I are talking about, because they've wrung some of the complexity out. And as we illustrated with the three patients going in for the same treatment, the reality is that medical providers could actually get about 60%, 65%, whatever the exact number is, of what they actually charge, and they would still be completely healthy and make money. So you could squeeze out 30 to 35 to 40% of costs just by having everybody insured and eliminating some of the crazy complexity of the system. And that's why medical care in this country is so expensive and so inefficient.
Okay, so how then, so I'm getting it now. So basically, you've showed us three models. There's the patient who is uninsured, and therefore they have medical payments from the government, or the hospital can get their money for up to $100,000 for, is it per visit? Per person or per visit?
I don't think there's really a limit. I was using $100,000 as an example.
Okay.
It just, whatever the, you know, can't be paid, normally the state governments pay it, and maybe they're reimbursed by the federal government. But usually indigent people are usually covered by some type of government plan.
Right.
But they're covered, ironically, at the highest possible billing rate.
So they're paid at the highest possible rate. Then there are people who are insured and under the big companies. They have contracts that basically give you a 40% decrease. And then there's Medicare, Medi-Cal, which a lot of our community is under, and docs are being reimbursed at 40%.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Those are rough numbers.
Rough
I'm just
numbers,
giving you
but, yeah.
the model. But that's definitely the general idea.
Exactly
right. Yep.
Wow.
Exactly right. So the solution, of course, you know, there's two solutions been presented. California has a state bill pending, which would provide a statewide program that would be funded by tax dollars within California that would be government funded. So if that bill passes, it hasn't been voted on yet, it's still in committee. It does have quite a few co-sponsors, at least in the assembly, but it hasn't come up for a vote yet. But if that bill were to pass, then California would have a plan where within the state of California, medical care would be paid by the state government through state taxes. So there'd be a single-payer system. It would still go to the same private hospitals. It doesn't really insist that the hospitals be nonprofit, but everybody in California would be covered. You'd have a very large insured pool. You would go to the doctor and hospital as you normally do, but the bill would be paid by the state of California. So there is a state solution that's been presented to the legislature in California. And there also, and that bill, I think, has some chance of passage. On the federal level, since the Congress, you know, both houses of Congress and the executive branch are controlled by Republicans at this time, John Conyers of Michigan has introduced a bill every year in Congress for many, many sessions, and Bernie Sanders has introduced a bill in the Senate. They're not exactly the same, but they would do the same thing nationally that the state bill in California would do, which is establish a national single-payer system, which they basically call Medicare for All. So they would simply take, and this is particularly true of Sanders' bill, I think Conyers' bill is slightly different, but it's the same principle. The principle is to say, look, as soon as you're born or enter the United States, you are covered by a universal health care. Everything is covered. There's no real exclusions. The hospital, everything's covered. You can't be turned down for treatment. And when the bill comes, the bill is paid by the government, and the government will establish some type of reimbursement plan so that it will be a lot less expensive in the long run for society as a whole. Obviously, those bills, which you know I support and many other Democrats support, doesn't have as good a prospect of passage because most of the Republican congressmen and senators are opposed to it. You know, they were all opposed to Obamacare, as you know. And Obamacare was a good, very good step in the right direction. It tried to control the rising cost of medical care by creating an individual mandate, but the mandate wasn't really strong enough. So it did decrease the uninsured pool quite a bit, and it did control costs. It was on the way to being successful, but of course it's being undermined, obviously quite successfully, by various political forces. So between strengthening Obamacare or enacting one of these other bills, that would really tackle head-on all of these problems that we've identified in this conversation.
Well, we were looking and working very closely and looking at what happened with the Affordable Care Act, which we now know as Obamacare. And it seemed to us that through the process, it was really what we ended up with was a handicapped version of what was originally the design. What we got gave us a lot more than we had, but it didn't give us everything that the original bill writers, had given it quite a bit of thought so that we wouldn't run into some of the problems that we've run into, but it was changed. People will ask us, or they're very curious about what happens when and you aren't in Congress yet, but what happens between when the bill gets sort of started and gets before the House, and what happens during that period of what gets proposed and finally what's decided that you're really going to end up voting on?
You mean in Congress, you mean specifically?
Well, Congress or even what's in front of even in, the state, state
well,
level.
Well, obviously, once particularly with the medical care bill, it is a very complex system in the United States. You have to lay out, so many factors about what is reimbursed, what is not reimbursed, what hospitals or how hospitals are treated, how doctors are treated. The federal bill that's been introduced in the Congress, for example, does mandate that hospitals have to be nonprofit. It does drive the profit margin out of the business as well, which would bring costs down even more from a social, point of view. But your point is very correct, Adrian, and it'll happen again, I'm sure. The bill that was originally proposed, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, was dramatically changed during negotiations to get it passed. And that's going to happen again. But I don't think that's the fundamental problem. The fundamental problem, I think, is the next step. If you go back and look at other large programs that pass, whether they're Social Security or Medicare or the drug program that passed for Medicare under President Bush, or even a non-medical program, an infrastructure plan, it really doesn't matter. Anytime a major bill is passed, what usually happens is very shortly after the bill passes, both sides get together and they do various kinds of improvements to the bill. So if you look at the history of any major social program, yes, there's a lot of compromises to get it passed, and that's understandable. That's part of the political process. Everybody doesn't have the same idea. You see the arguments we're having in this country over birth control coverage and abortion coverage, and hospice care coverage now has become an issue. Should it be covered? Dental care sometimes is not covered in these plans. Optical plans sometimes not included in national health plans around the world. So there are a lot of questions to address in putting together a final bill. And in that process, some legitimate numbers of people might say, look, we really shouldn't cover dental plan. You know, we can let private insurance companies sell supplemental plans, so we're going to provide basic coverage through taxpayer-supported plans. But there will be an opportunity for individuals to buy some extra coverage for dental plan and whatever else you might want to include. I think that's the natural part of the process. What really made Obamacare difficult was that after the bill passed, instead of getting together to improve the plan, one side started to immediately to sabotage it. And that's really the tragedy. If we get another bill passed of any type, if one political force begins to sabotage it, you'll never have the opportunity to improve it. If we had a chance to get in there as it first passed, as Affordable Care, and then improve it, I think we'd have a very good outcome right now. But the exact opposite happened. It's been constantly undermined by conservative political forces.
So what can we do as citizens, as advocates for better health care? What suggestions do you have for us? What can we do while this is going on?
Well, I think the critical point right now, we are at a very interesting point in that regard, Adrian. This is the first time, maybe ever, in my lifetime, that there really is a very large-scale movement amongst the public for some type of single-payer system. So anybody that's interested should really make sure that any time they're considering a vote for an assemblyman in the state of California, a state senate in California, or Congress, they should make sure that that person supports single-payer systems. It doesn't really matter what the details are, because as you said, the details can be hammered out in compromise and nobody will get exactly what they want, but what you're looking for is a commitment to some form of universal health care single-payer system. That's the key. We need universal health care. Everybody has to be covered and has to be a single-payer system so that the government somehow is the single payer for the system. And people who are listening and interested in this issue have to make sure that they insist that every candidate agrees that that's their goal.
I like that. So we're going to take a break, and you can find out more about us on accessadvocacy.org, on our internet page, Twitter, or Facebook. We'll be right back and continue our discussion with Andy Thorburn, candidate for Congress for the state of California. So I want to welcome you back. Thanks for joining us today. We're going to continue our discussion with Andy Thorburn, candidate for Congress in the state of California. We've had this really interesting discussion about insurance and gotten some real insight as to how it works. One of the things that we mentioned that was really unique to our country is that traditionally health insurance has been paid through employers. Now,
in the United States, yes, that's a little bit unusual. The United States is the only advanced nation that has tied medical insurance to employment status. It's a very, very, very rare occurrence.
And, I was kind of in that mix where I was an independent contractor, consultant, and so I had to keep my insurance policies because of Marissa's sickle cell. And there was a time when I had to keep two insurance policies going at the same time. One for when she capped out, and then I had to have a second one so that at that point we had, I think it was either a three-month or a six-month period before they would cover a pre-existing condition. So I would have sometimes half a year where I was paying for two insurance policies, right?
It's just, correct. Yep. Sure.
Well,
that's the reality of our system. And in fact, up until we had passed another federal law about 10 years ago. Before that law passed, it's called COBRA. Before we had a COBRA law, one of the drawbacks of tying health insurance to employment is that it's not very portable. So you would have many, many situations. The first healthcare crisis that we had in recent decades revolved around an issue similar to what you just identified. Most people did get employment through their, got insurance through their employment status. So what would happen is they would get sick, maybe a serious illness, and maybe they would recover and they continue to work, and then they would leave that job and become, as you did, you know, an independent contractor, and then they'd apply for insurance as an individual, and they'd be turned down. And the new insurance guy would say, I can't take you on as insurance. You have diabetes. You have cancer. You had cancer. Yes, you recovered from the cancer, but you could have it again. Or you had a heart attack. You might have another heart attack. I can't be in a position as an insurance company of getting $3,000 or $5,000 in premium from you when there's a very high probability that in the next 2 or 3 years I'll have to pay out hundreds of thousands of dollars for your condition. So people did not have portability. So we addressed that partially years ago, probably 15 years ago, with a law that's called COBRA, which enabled employees who were leaving employment status to keep their employment on the group basis for 18 months. So there was a long period of time until the Affordable Care Act came in when COBRA was one of the things that helped people, you know, get coverage until they got another job with another employer. So it was a kind of stopgap measure, and it did save a tremendous amount of lives, and it did save a tremendous amount of aggravation, so people could, and they, you had to pay your own premium. It wasn't paid by the employer, but you could stay on the group plan, pay the premiums every month at a group rate, and of course you didn't have to worry about pre-existing conditions because you were covered continuously. But of course it wasn't portable. And that whole area that we're talking about is something that is unique to the United States. And one of the unintended consequences of it is that it has made United States industry uncompetitive with foreign competitors. There's a lot of talk about, American automobile industry and the steel industry. And though there's many factors involved in global competition, one of the factors has been the fact that Ford Motor Company or General Motors, they have to pay for medical care from the sale of their cars. Whereas in Germany, it's paid by the taxpayers of the entire country. So Volkswagen and Mercedes, or in Japan, Toyota, et cetera, they don't have to build into the price of their cars the necessity to pay health insurance premiums. Now, I haven't seen a recent number, and this is before the Affordable Care Act, so the numbers would be different now. But during the recession, when the 2008 recession hit, it came out that when you buy an American car, probably there's as much as $1,500 of the price of that car, which is what the company needs to pay the medical benefits of its workforce, including, in the case of the automobile insurance and automobile industry, they pay for the medical insurance for their retired workers as well. So every time you buy a car, Ford is at a $1,500 disadvantage compared to Volkswagen, where that $1,500 or the equivalent, whatever it is in Germany, is paid by taxpayers. So the whole area that you opened up about healthcare being tied to employment has had a whole sequence of unintended consequences, all of which are basically negative. And the whole idea of Obamacare was to create the exchanges, so if you didn't have employment healthcare, you could get it without discrimination on a private exchange. And, of course, the next step would be to go to a single-payer system, and then it would have nothing to do with employment status. Everybody would be covered automatically by tax dollars.
In my dreams.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, it would be a dream replacing basically a nightmare. So the system we have now is essentially nightmarish in its complexity. So it would be nice to get a simpler system. You know, this is a little off. Historically, it's interesting to note that the whole idea of employers paying for health care was actually resisted by the employees. It was first proposed to the United Auto Workers, and the president of the United Auto Workers predicted that that is not a good idea. It will make you uncompetitive in the long run. But after many negotiations, and they wouldn't give out enough money in terms of raises and other benefits, the United Auto Workers accepted health insurance as part of a contract in the 1950s. And from there, it spread to other industries, and before you know it, our entire healthcare system had a foundation of being tied to employment status. And you know, for several decades, we got away with that because healthcare costs weren't that high. But as healthcare costs began to go up much faster than the general rate of inflation, that foundation of being tied to employment status turned out to be very unsound. It made the medical care itself not portable, as well as making the employers that had to provide it not competitive. So the history of it is quite ironic that the company, the employees, didn't even want it to be covered in contracts, but it ended up that way for historical reasons, and we're paying quite a price for it now.
I think we're going to have to do a sort of game where we say, okay, what did you learn from our interview? I never knew that. Although, you know, it does make sense that this kind of came in, as you said, on a large scale, because at that time they were, of course, General Motors and the union. They were huge. They were a huge part of the American economy.
They were, exactly. Then the United Auto Workers was a gigantic union, had millions of members and very well-respected union, a very progressive union. And, you know, they didn't really think this was a good idea in the long run, but as part of negotiations at a time when the economy was pretty strong, they agreed to it. And, you know, it has come back. It turned out to be a mistake. You know, we would have been much better off if somehow we had found the political will to do a single-payer system at that time, which is about the time that our peers in Europe were adopting single-payer systems. But we missed that opportunity, and we went along with our own system for many decades. And, for a while, it wasn't so bad, but it has become a crisis. The first part of the crisis became the fact that there were so many tens of millions of people whose employer didn't have it, didn't pay for it, because it was voluntary for an employer to have health care. So many, many smaller employers couldn't afford it. And the larger employers were getting clobbered with higher premiums, so they kept putting more and more of the premium onto the employee, and the employer paid a smaller and smaller percentage of it. And then there were, as you mentioned, the independent contractors who had nothing to turn to except the private market, which was very selective, turned down many people. So we ended up with a huge crisis. Obamacare was a response to that crisis, and now we really find ourselves in a kind of limbo where Obamacare is not being supported, and the next generation solution is on the table, but doesn't yet have enough scale behind it. It doesn't really have enough of a critical mass of supporters to push it over the finish line. So we have to focus on getting the next generation solution, getting a critical mass of the public behind that single payer idea to get to the next level where we need to be.
Well, I think this is a perfect segue for us to maybe talk a bit about employability and where we are in terms of jobs in California. So as all my listeners know, I'm very, very much involved in the biomedical field here in state of California. And we have under CIRM, which is the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine, we have created here in California this huge network from top to bottom of these top class stem cell research centers. And we have, as a result of that, we have this huge brain trust in that field. And we're employing many, many scientists, the biomedical companies who are trying to bring product and solutions actually to consumers are growing. They're having, you know, marketing, training, reps, all of this industry has just built a great tax base for us. Now, the fear is that as the country becomes more and more conservative, do you think that we as Californians can do to protect that brain trust and to ensure that the state of California continues to support this sort of work?
Well, you know, just by coincidence, it happens to be that, as you know, one of those centers is right here in Orange County at the University of California at Irvine. They have a very robust stem cell center. And as it happens, next Wednesday, my wife Karen is leading a few friends on a tour of that stem cell facility, so we're not as involved as you are, but we're very aware and involved in the tremendous job that the state of California has done in providing funding for that. I really don't think that California is in any danger right now, because it is, on the whole, in the aggregate, very progressive state on most of these issues. And I think California will continue to fund these things very robustly and continue to be a leader. The real challenge we have is, you know, to get the rest of the country behind California. You mentioned that the country, unfortunately, is quite conservative now, and that's clearly true. There is, you know, in my dream, my dream is that what we're going through is the last gasp of this old-fashioned, non-inclusive, you know, conservative mindset. That this is their, they see that the world is slipping away from them, that we're becoming an inclusive society. We're moving towards, you know, single-payer health care. We're moving towards embracing immigrants and diversity, and we're embracing, you know, transgender people, and we're embracing Muslim immigrants, and we're not kicking them out. And I like to think that what we're witnessing now is the last gasp of that mindset. And I have legitimately high hopes that we're headed towards a renaissance of progressive thought. And not that it will happen immediately, you know, in one election cycle or one event. But I really think there's an aura to me about all these cross currents. If you look at the conservative movement in the country, just in today's paper, there had to be four or five stories. The front page story in today's New York Times is about how the Republican Party is coming apart at the seams. The leaders of the party are totally out of touch with many, many aspects of the so-called, you know, base of the party. The base of the party itself is split between those who want to punish anybody who didn't follow Trump's line right down the road and those who want to believe in a kind of different form of Republican Party. So the point of all that is, I think there's legitimate hope that we're living through a conservative epoch, but it will be short-lived, that it's really the last of this prejudice, this you know, exclusivity, this closed-mindedness, this ability to deny facts, and the anti-scientific, anti-intellectual element of the Republican Party, which is now in control. I really have legitimate hope that it's dying out, and as each of the next election cycles will begin to return to a more progressive agenda.
Well, you know what they say across the country, as California goes, so does the rest of the nation. So I'm certainly hoping that's true.
I hope it is, though. I mean, it is, right now it's just a hope, but I do see a lot of signs out there that it might turn out to be true.
I mean, I feel like, and this might be dating this program, but I feel like we should have this conversation about, in light of what happened in Las Vegas with the shooter, and the fact that my daughter, who is a student at a major university, called me the next day, and there had been an alarm sent out from her university that there was a gunman on her campus, and she was calling me from a room, and she was in this room all alone, you know, with her cell phone, and because they had just said there's a gun, and we're investigating, and they just rushed all the students inside, and she calls me from this room, and she was already trying to wrap her head around what had happened in Las Vegas, that someone could do something that horrific, and then to have her own campus a place where something like that could happen. What do you see that we can do, or what would you propose could be done about the fact that we're selling these really, really dangerous firearms to everyday people?
It is quite a tragedy, and it is it's one of the great mysteries of our political culture, how gun rights came to be such an article of faith with so many people that they refuse to accept even sensible restrictions. But I think, I do think a major part of the problem does come back to money and politics. You know, most of the polls show that a large majority of the public, a large majority, sometimes an overwhelming majority, does support, both Republicans and Democrats, various forms of gun controls that would at least reduce would never eliminate, but would reduce this carnage that goes on a regular basis in the United States. Whether, you know, background checks, eliminating certain kinds of weapons completely, eliminating certain kinds of cartridges and the bullets and so forth. There's a whole raft of sensible regulations that the public seems to actually support. But it doesn't get passed because we have this tremendous stranglehold. Money has this tremendous stranglehold. Our political process is so drawn out and so expensive that people end up owing their allegiance to organizations that fund their campaigns. And so the gun lobby has enormous power. We really need to build a very strong coalition. And I believe this is a much tougher fight than health care. I think the health care fight is quite winnable in a relatively near term, whether that's, you know, this cycle or next two cycles. But the gun lobby has a hold on American culture that is really quite mystical. It's really hard to figure out. But the answer is always the same. People who realize the danger and insanity of the current, political environment have to build coalitions. We have to go out into our families and friends and take this issue on and say, look, it's not, an equitable way to interpret our laws. We need to protect people. It's simple. We need to protect people. And we have to fight back against this crazy propaganda that guns make you safe. Guns don't make you safe. They're dangerous. But it's the same. I think it always comes back to kind of organizing. You have an idea, and you have to organize people, grassroots people, behind that idea. That's what happened with California with stem cells. You know, the federal government was deciding that stem cell research violated certain religious principles and cut out the money for it. But in California, there was a grassroots movement to pick that up and push it, and we pushed it through, and we funded it to very, very handsomely in this state. So we have to do the same thing with gun control. California can continue to pass stricter laws than the country as a whole, and that is somewhat effective, but we do have to really devote ourselves to grassroots campaigns to get sensible gun registration. I don't have high hopes that will happen quickly, but we still have to take on the task.
Well, this whole thing about the guns always really surprises me, because my most religious friends are also believers in guns. I mean, I think you're right. I think it's much harder than having a discussion about healthcare. It's almost as hard as having the discussion about stem cells, because of course we get a lot of pushback on that, and what the religious argument about what was meant to be versus humans tampering, or the whole discussion about life being something that's mystical and magical as opposed to something that we can study and understand and improve.
Correct. Yeah, I think we've been the victim of a very large-scale, well-funded propaganda campaign that on certain issues, including gun control, has changed or seized control of the debate and seized control of the language. And there's many issues where that's true, and I think that's really one of the things that happened with gun control. There's been a lot of money spent, so people forget that the Second Amendment is not written in the same absolute language as the First Amendment. It has a very specific limiting clause in the beginning of it, having to do with a well-regulated militia. But, you know, after decades of propaganda in newspapers and magazines funded by the National Rifle Association and published in right-wing journals, they've seized control of the debate. And so we have to push back against that and try to point out, you know, the fallacies of that debate. You know, and that's one of the things we're up against. We've had this very successful propaganda campaign on several issues, and you know, they've outgunned, you know, the opposition, so to speak, on some of these issues. And
yeah.
So people have a misconception about the historical circumstances of the Second Amendment.
Yeah, I had a discussion like that with someone where they were like, well, the founding fathers meant for us to be able to protect ourselves. I said, well, but at that point you were using, you know, rifles, I think, and a musket. And you had to make one bullet at a time. You know what I mean? And the argument has been, oh, no, they could foresee us having guns and the technology that that we currently have. And I think really what we have to do is, as you said, organize and advocate and maybe get together, get stories out that aren't news stories, but maybe personalized stories about the dangers of having gun and the questioning, again, the need to have guns, which have so much firepower.
I think that's right. There's always reason for optimism. And one of the reasons that I would be optimistic about any issue is if you look at what happened to the issue of the status in society of lesbian and gay people, the LGBT movement. You know, that wasn't really gaining much traction for decades. It was out there as an issue, and they were looking to be treated more equitably and have a fair place in society and not be discriminated against and be so much the subject of so much, you know, mockery. And it didn't gain a lot of traction. And then in a relatively short time, in a couple of years almost, the issue emerged, and in a very short period of time, society became very accepting of a same-sex marriage, and it's not unusual to see gay couples, and they're pretty much welcome to most places. There's a little pushback now under the Trump administration, of course. But if you look at what happened over a relatively short period, somehow, I don't know exactly that I could explain it, but sometimes social movements suddenly catch fire, and the vocabulary changes. When the vocabulary changes and somebody finds the right way to get into people's heads with it, they say, oh, yeah, that's perfect. Oh, yeah, I get it. Yeah, that's great. It's perfectly okay with me. And I think that's what has to happen with guns. We have to find some way. And if we do find that way, although it's a very bleak picture right now in terms of gun control, it's always there's always reason to be optimistic that if we find the right vocabulary, we can turn it around. And when you turn it around, it can happen more quickly than you think.
Well, I'm optimistic, as I hope everyone else out there that's listening are optimistic too. So what we're going to do is now I can't believe this time has gone so quickly. I think we're going to have to bring you back to discuss some other issues.
My pleasure.
Okay, so once again, we've here with Andy Thorburn, who's running for Congress in the state of California for District 39. You can find out more about him at
ThorburnForCongress.com. And I should mention, just for the people listening, the 39th District, just so they know, is the district around Fullerton, California. It's Fullerton. It's in Orange County. It's mostly Fullerton and Brea, La Habra, Yorba Linda. That area of California is the 39th District, just so your listeners have some idea where it is.
Well, thank you very much, and we'll be right back. Well, we're all out of time today, but before we go, I wanted to let you know that you can learn more about our organization on our website, accessadvocacy.org, or on the Access Advocacy Facebook page. That's AXISAdvocacy.org. Join us again next Tuesday on thepowerofvoices.com at noon Pacific, or listen anytime on demand at accessadvocacy.org. You'll find all our programs there. I'm Adrienne Shapiro. Thank you for listening. Yeah.